Welcome to the latest edition of the Wax Ecstatic Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining us once again as we continue to dig through the childhood memories and, most importantly, digging through this monster box of baseball cards. As you've noticed, things slow down a little bit once you get into the early 90s because there's so many card sets. Well, one of the big three had a decent set in 1991. Of course, when you compare it to the 1990 set, that's not much of a compliment. However, the 91 Donruss set is one that I've actually liked over the years. I wouldn't say it is a must-collect set, but it's certainly one you could take a look at purely for fun. You're not going to make any money off of this set, even the star cards. And case in point, our random pull, Ken Griffey Jr., card number 77 in that set. And if Ken Griffey Jr., a third-year card for the kid who is starting to ascend the popularity mountain in 1991, if that is in a common box of cards, and that's what a lot of these cards in this monster box are, then that pretty much tells you about the state of 91 Donruss and about baseball cards in 1991. A card like this may, if you're lucky, you may get a dollar for it, but typically far less than that because there are far too many of these cards out there. But we'll talk about the 91 Donruss set. It was a very interesting set for a number of reasons. And also Ken Griffey Jr.'s career. We're not going to go through the litany of stats like I often do and trades and stuff like that because, well, I mean, it's Ken Griffey Jr. You know, this is pretty much like Reggie Jackson. You know, he was the random pull in the 87 Tops podcast. So we're going to do a little less analytics, talk some memories of Ken Griffey Jr., however, later on in the podcast. After we take a look at your comments from our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and we encourage you to always comment about not just our podcast or any of the players that we talk about on the podcast, but anything about the hobby in general. If you have a pack break that you've done, if you find a card from a set that we discussed that you want to share with us, then by all means, share it with us. We're open 24/7. Wax and Gum Stains is the Twitter handle. And we had plenty of reaction to our previous podcast on the disaster that is 1991 Fleer. Of course, pretty much everybody hates this set for a number of reasons. And I went into detail of those reasons on our last podcast, but most notably the color from the set, the mustard yellow, the rubber duck yellow, the rain slicker yellow. It was such a bright and loud yellow that it turned off a lot of card collectors instantly. It was just too loud of a card. And then you have the other problems, just general design flaws, bad photography, and then on top of that, the fact that there were millions, and I do literally mean millions of each card produced by Fleer in that set, and that's something that would be a problem for the industry for many, many years. Well, somebody actually said he likes the set, although I don't know if he's joking. I guess we'll find out. Marcus, also known as Marcus SDTX, responding to a tweet where we called it an annoying set, and it is annoying. He says, annoying, this is a top five all-time favorite set for me. And he continues, I have only once customized a phone case, and this was it. And he shares a picture of his cell phone, which is a 91 Fleer Tony Gwynn card. And it's Gwynn wearing the old Padre brown. Of course, they would abandon that color scheme going into the 1991 season. But there he is wearing the old Padre brown, staring at the umpire, looking to get a favorable call there. Now, I'm thinking you customize with this particular card because it looks like your phone is also very loud yellow. So it actually kind of goes. But it's interesting that you chose, of all cards, of all Tony Gwynn cards, the 91 Fleer one, because I don't know if that's his best action shot, although it does provide a very unique perspective of the game. You know, Gwynn didn't strike out hardly at all in his career, so if he's making an argument with the umpire, then clearly he was meeting his match on the mound because he didn't see too many pitches thrown at him that were called strikes. And like I said, he wasn't rung up that often in his career. So, Marcus, thank you for sharing the picture of your 91 FLIR customized cell phone there in the Tony Gwynn card. A lot of people have hate for the set. And understandably so. They're complaining about the color. They're complaining about the photography. And Kevin Hickerson goes on about the photography. He says the art cards were a waste in that monstrosity of a set. Also, some action shots were cropped horribly. The irony, of course, is that the box states, quote unquote, improved action shots while actually making them worse than the year before. That is an excellent point that you make there, Kevin. And it's funny, we teed up our podcast with a picture of a box of 91 FLIR. And if you look at the bottom of the front of the box, they have this explosive star, you know, one of those wow kind of looks to it. And it says new full color backs. Okay, well, they did have full color backs, but I mean, you could argue that the backs of the cards were always full color. I mean, nobody just put out a black and white back to a card. So that's a little deceptive advertising there. Two player pictures per card. That's right. That was true. And then there is the bullet point here that is really angering our audience. Improved action photos. And certainly it didn't improve in Kevin's mind, and I don't blame you one bit. So, Kevin, thank you for sharing those thoughts there. And, yeah, the photography really is awful. And while you're complaining about the way too tight action shots, I just point to our random poll, the Luis Gonzalez card, where Luis just looks really uncomfortable, really awkward. And it, again, looks like the lights are out in the stadium that he's in, the dark stadium, while he's wearing the dark Astros batting practice jersey. It just does not make for a good look. And that pretty much sums up the 91 FLIR set photography. It was just disastrous, and nobody liked that, on top of the loud yellow and all of the other design flaws that they had. So plenty of comments about how bad the set was, and I am not going to argue with that. It was a pretty terrible set. So no love lost for the 91 FLIR set, and it's not as bad as 82 FLIR. 82 FLIR was just an absolute mess. I mean, you know, 91 FLIR, and I said this in the podcast, it's like they tried to upgraded and tried to match some of the premium cards that were being made that year, but they just fell way short. You know, it was one of those good job, good effort kind of situations there where they wanted to make it look sharp and prestigious and stand out amongst some of the other cards from 91, but instead they just made an absolute mess out of it. And 25 years later, it is still one of the most unpopular card sets, not only of the year, but you look back over the last 35 years, you know, ever since FLIR became a consistent product. You know, they released baseball cards in 1963. They did some football cards as well. But when they were an officially licensed product starting in 81, if you look back at that 35-year history of baseball cards, if there was a top 10 list of worst baseball cards made, 91 FLIR is probably dangerously close to the top five. And that's actually a very good question that we're going to ask our fans. Top 10 worst baseball cards ever made. And we're not talking about specific cards, no, not like individual cards, but just the sets. So share those with us at Wax and Gum Stains. I'm curious to see where you rank the worst of the worst. In order, please, go 1 through 10, top to bottom, and we'll talk about that in our next podcast coming up on Tuesday. All right, let's talk about the release from 1991, Donruss. It's a set that a lot of people didn't like right off the bat. I actually did like it then. I still like it now. It is not in my list of top 10 best sets. In fact, it is a very average set. But like I was saying before, when you look at the 1990 set, you know, the bar was set pretty low with that set. So Donruss, whatever they produced in 91, was going to be better. Now, the biggest thing about the 91 Donruss set was it was big. Now, not as big as 1990 Score, but much like FLIR starting to inflate the size of the sets, Donruss did that too, a 770 card base set. But what was different in how Donruss released that was in two series. And this is something that would become very, very common beginning in 1991. And of course, you know, breaking up a set into series is nothing new. That was something that Topps did every year for many, many years. And it was a practice that they ended after the 1973 set. They were producing just one big set in 1974 so that collectors could get the entire set all at once, or try to collect the entire set all at once, instead of waiting every few weeks, or, you know, roughly once a month, you know, waiting for the next set of cards to come out, the next series of 100 cards or whatever to come out to try to complete a set. Well, that, of course, led to the infamous Washington National League card when the San Diego Padres were almost sold and moved to Washington, D.C. in the 1974 offseason. That wasn't the case, so it was a good idea by Topps, but then they had to scramble to correct all the cards that they labeled Washington National League, had to relabel them San Diego Padres in a second release of the set, if you will, later on in the 1974 season. So series was nothing new, but for this generation of card collectors, it was new. And again, it was because fans wanted updated cards, updated pictures. You know, if teams had new jerseys or new players, you wanted to see them. And again, the rookie force behind it, that was another big reason why card companies, even though they expanded the size of a set, they wanted to split up the sets into series. And another reason why series were being reintroduced into the hobby, you could insert different chase cards. So it was also a money grab by the card companies to try to build in as many different subsets and insert cards and chase cards as possible. So this was the first time that Donruss did the series dance. And basically what they did was release essentially the same type of card. They just changed the color, and it wasn't all that different from what Score did, where, you know, they had different colors for every 110 cards in the set. But Score in Series 2 would basically repeat the color scheme. You know, you had dark blue, black, and teal, and then white, and then they just cycled through that color scheme again in the second series. Well, with Donruss, Series 1 was a predominantly dark blue card, not just on the front, but also on the back of the card. Series 2 was a dark green, almost like an emerald green on the front and on the back. So when we're looking at this Ken Griffey Jr. card, this is a Series 1 card. Just remember that if you are looking at any kind of Series 2 card, it would be green. So you look at the 91 Donruss card, and you have that blue, or in some cases, green border. You have the photograph right in the middle, taking up about 80% of the front of the card. This was one of the limitations to Donruss that year. With this design, the photography was cropped down quite a bit. It did not take up a lot of the front of the card, which many more card companies were looking to do starting in 1991, and especially Topps. Topps not only did that with their base set, but certainly with Topps Stadium Club. But Donruss kind of went against the grain, opting for a smaller sized photograph. But by doing so, they also allowed for diagonal cuts. And what I mean by that is the rest of the design has this diagonal look to it. And that look is very popular today in graphic design, and not just in baseball cards. And actually, you know, Topps had quite a bit of a diagonal cut in their card design in 2016, and I'm sure in 2017 they'll have a lot of the similar looks to it and similar feel with that cut. But if you look at a lot of advertising these days, a lot of video marketing, you will notice that the lines that are you know, in still shots or in wipes from one shot to another, they're diagonal. They cut from one side to the other. And that is mostly because, especially in television advertising, everyone has an HDTV these days, and they are more rectangular than square, like the old standard definition TVs were. So the diagonal cuts actually stand out. It takes up more of the screen. So even though the photography was limited here because of the cropping of the photograph to get the design in, this was very forward-thinking design by Donruss. Now, it's not the first time that diagonal cuts have been used in the overall design. Right off the top of my head, I know 85 Topps had that with the nameplate of the team on the front of the card. Now, it didn't cut across the entire front of the card, but you catch my drift there. You know, that was a prominent feature in that. 88 Fleer also using diagonal cuts with the background, where even though the photograph basically blended into the white background, you had the red and blue stripes going across the card diagonally. So that was almost what Donruss did here in 91, except instead of just almost like these straight confetti pieces of paper going across, you had this very Saved by the Bell look with this design here. You have this, it's almost like a tire track impression, and you have these straight lines as well. And going from top to bottom, you have these parallel lines of one color, in this case, purple. Next, you have that tire track line, or it actually kind of looks like the bubblegum stain that you would get in Topps cards in white on the left. Go down a little more, you have that tire track impression once again, a slightly narrower stripe in orange. And then you go to the right side of the card, you have one purple line, three yellow lines, and then that white tire track impression again. Now go from that lower white tire track impression to the left side, and you see blue and red stripes, just one on top of the other, parallel, but again, a diagonal cut. And then at the bottom of the picture, you have the player name in a red stripe diagonally, his position in a blue stripe, a narrower blue stripe diagonally. And while all of this is going on, too, you have the team logo on the front. And again, I'm a big fan of that, so that deserves a check mark, in my opinion. And the Donruss logo, very small, up in the upper left-hand corner. So this is a very, very busy card. It's almost as busy as 90 Tops. We've joked about that as being a Saved by the Bell or In Living Color or Hammer Pants card. Same thing with 1990 Score, you know, very similar, very pop look, very contemporary. And I think that's something that, in my opinion, when this set came out, one reason why I liked it, I was 13 years old when I first bought a box of this, and this was a set that I liked so much after I bought a pack or two. I actually went out and bought a whole box. It was one of the first boxes of cards that I bought. And that is, for a 13-year-old kid, this was a very cool look. Now, for adults, then and now, it is very tacky and, like I said, dizzying. It is a very confusing, busy look here. And it is dated. It is very much dated. You know, like those other sets I brought up, 90 Score and 90 Tops, there's a lot going on here. And it has a 1991 feel to it. This has some Belle Biv DeVoe, some ABC, some Tony look to it. Kind of has that feel. I'm sorry if I just made you have these really bad early 90s pop songs pop in your head. But when I look at it, it says 1991. So it is dated. There's no doubt about that. But I think when you look at having the contemporary feel and something that I've mentioned in several podcasts before about catching the feeling of the times, you know, that moment of 1991, boy, Donruss definitely did that. And I've always liked Series 1 over Series 2 because this design works a lot better with the dark blue. With the dark green, it gets kind of lost. Some of the colors get muted a little bit. Flip the card over, and you have your standard Donruss back. This would be the last year that you would see this type of back to a card when Donruss did a complete overhaul and upgrade to their cards in 1992. They got rid of this and went with more of what you saw on the back of a Fleer Ultra card or a Leaf card, you know, with photographs blended in with stats and full color backs, not just basically a two-tone back here. And, you know, even though the Donruss company went with pretty much the same look here, it has a cool look to it. Very similar to the 88 and 86 sets where you have a dark blue background, you've got the white text box, and then you've got the black text and a little black line going across with the standard Donruss back features. Again, this is something that you've seen ever since, for the most part, since 1982 with very few changes. Player's name up top, but you didn't know that Ken Griffey Jr.'s birth name is George Kenneth Griffey Jr. Card number 77. You've got the recent major league performance, which has always driven me crazy, although Griffey was just in his third year here, so it actually works. And then a slew of career highlights in the text box, and pretty much every player had a few sentences of career highlights because Donruss only showed 5 years of major league activity. So when you look back at the 91 Donruss set, and again, I'm biased because I liked it when it came out. It certainly hit its target market. I was a 13-year-old boy who loved baseball and loved collecting baseball cards. it worked for me then, and I still look back on these cards in terms of a design and style and popularity then and now. I still look back at it fondly. I actually like this set in terms of, again, design and, you know, certainly availability then and now. Now, that is the problem with this set. Much like every other set of baseball cards from 1991, there are just too many of these sets out there. And I mean, way too many. This is actually in the same realm of 91 Fleer, which just had way too many as well. In fact, I mentioned last time in our last podcast that there are reports that 3 million copies of each card were made. Now, that's an unofficial number, but still, 3 million of each card. It's a 770-card set, and that's not including all of the inserts. You know, you have the Grand Slammer cards, you had the Elite cards. There was a signature series with Ryne Sandberg as well, as they were getting into the autograph card insert sets. You know, there are, you do the math there. I mean, 3 million times 770. I mean, that's almost 25 million cards just out there. That is just insane. So understandably, prices are way down. I've seen boxes for Series 1 or Series 2 running anywhere between $10 and $15, not including shipping. I've actually seen some listed for $15, including shipping. So having been somebody who has shipped whole boxes before, they are not cheap to ship, depending on how you move them out. Probably about $12 to $14 for a box of cards to ship it. So you're essentially just paying for shipping. So if you take shipping out, you're basically paying a dollar for a box of 36 wax packs. Wow. The set also goes for roughly $15 to $20. I lean more towards the $15. And the complete collector set, by the way, is 792 cards. You get 22 bonus cards that were included just in the set, the factory set, and not in you know, any kind of inserted method. So in a way, Donruss was trying to match Topps. Topps had for a very long time had a 792 card base set, and that is what they were able to accomplish that year. So, you know, 91 Donruss, there's plenty of it out there. And like I said, it's in my opinion, it's a nice looking set. You've got plenty of rookies. You've got some young stars in there. But it is something that if you're trying to make any money off of it, forget about it. It is just not worth it. I think it's a fun set if you have a few packs to just kind of rip through and look at some of the cards. But even if you pull a Ken Griffey Jr. card, and Griffey was just the absolute bomb in Major League Baseball back then, like I said, you might get a dollar for it. Might. But like most every other collector, even star cards like that, well, they ended up in the commons box. You know, they were only kept because they were star players, and much of my 91 Donruss cards went out the door about 10 or 12 years ago when I cleaned out most of my collection, kept the good cards and kept the older cards and a lot of the cards from 1991 and, let's say, 2 or 3 years before and 2 or 3 years after were sold so I could just get some supplies to hold all of those cards. Also should mention, and Donruss was making the rookie set for many, many years, but Donruss continued with the rookie set. It was a 56-card subset, very much like the updated and traded sets that we talked about. I remember buying it in 1991 because you had guys like Chuck Knoblauch, who was the Rookie of the Year that year. I believe Mo Vaughn was in that set as well. And basically, they took the standard Donruss base card design and they went with the red background, not with all the lines and tire tracks, though. It was just a red background. And you can actually buy that entire set now for just a couple of dollars. You can find that pretty cheap everywhere else. So 91 Donruss, in my opinion, a good-looking card, certainly a much improved card compared to 1990. But a lot of collectors didn't like it then. They don't like it now. And it's not just because of design. It's just because of oversaturation. It's a fun set. Again, if you have 10 or 15 bucks you just want to blow, and open up a whole bunch of wax packs or buy a complete set. I think it's worthy of that, but outside of just having a fun ripping open several packs of cards situation, I wouldn't invest too much time or money into this particular set. Now, Ken Griffey Jr., like I said at the start of this podcast, I'm not going to sit here and go running through year by year or even the trades. I mean, it's very well known what he did as a ball player, mostly because even if you didn't watch Ken Griffey Jr. or know much about him, he was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame this past summer, just a few months ago, and he came in with the highest clearance of votes. It was near unanimous. He moved past Tom Seaver, who was elected in 1993, and Seaver was nearly perfect. I think he only had two or three people hold out. Well, Griffey came in to the Hall of Fame with 99.3% of the vote. I don't know what 0.7% of the voters were looking at, or if they thought it was Ken Griffey Sr. accidentally on the ballot. But yeah, Griffey is about as close to a unanimous Hall of Famer as possible. Again, presumably doing all this without steroids. And I think it's safe to say that there's really been no link or hints or allegations that he was doing this in the unclean way, if you will. Purely natural, 22-year career, .284 career batting average, 630 home runs, 1,836 RBI, 13-time All-Star, most of those All-Star appearances with the Seattle Mariners. He's one of the big reasons why the Mariners are still in Seattle. Basically, since opening day of 1977, the Mariners were rumored to be moving somewhere else, but Griffey was a big reason why the team survived. And of course, the team's surprising 1995 playoff run was, you know, that was in particular pointed out to as why the Mariners are still there, because after winning that series, everybody loved the Mariners. They built Safeco Field because of that just a few years later. And the Mariners are in very good standing right now. In fact, Nintendo selling them a few months back for like 8 times what they were bought for. And the Mariners were one of those teams that almost moved to Tampa St. Pete. I remember that. They were having some pretty intense negotiations, and then the Nintendo company came in, I want to say 1991, maybe early 1992, and they were able to keep the team in Seattle and get a new ballpark out of it. But the funny story about Ken Griffey Jr. and the Mariners is that it is plausible that the Pittsburgh Pirates could have had Ken Griffey Jr. had fate fallen in their favor. And what I mean by that is if Griffey Jr. was a year older or a year younger and the Pirates finished with the worst record in Major League Baseball, they would have had the first pick overall. Now, the entry draft in Major League Baseball has changed quite a bit over the last 10 or 12 years, but for a long time, in fact, for 40 years, the first 40 years of the draft, because the Major League Baseball organization was trying to make this as fair as possible and not encourage basically tanking so that the worst team would always get the first pick, as opposed to doing a lottery system like the NBA and the NHL do. Major League Baseball said, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to alternate the number one pick with the worst team in the American League and the worst team in the National League. So in even years, the worst National League team would pick first, and then you would go AL and then move on to, you know, the records from top to bottom, or bottom to top, I guess you can say. So in even years, it was the National League that got the first pick. In odd years, it was the American League that got the worst pick, or got the first pick with the worst record. You know what I mean. So in 1986, the Seattle Mariners, again bumbling their way to the finish line, they would finish the season with a record of 67 wins and 95 losses, while the Pittsburgh Pirates would finish the season with 64 wins and 98 losses. But because they were going into an odd number year, the Mariners got the first pick. And were they ever fortunate to get the first pick? Because Griffey was a bona fide star even before he made it to the major leagues. Of course, the son of Ken Griffey Sr., longtime member of the Reds, also played with the Braves and the Yankees. Well, Griffey grows up in Ohio, in the Cincinnati area, goes to Archbishop Mueller High School, and that's the same school where Barry Larkin played. He was the best high school baseball player of the year in 1987. So if you're the Seattle Mariners, you're like, well, duh. I mean, this, we've got the number one pick. We've got this kid who is the, you know, across the board number one selection. So it was a no-brainer for them to pick him, and they did. They made him the first overall selection in 1987. And the rest is history. Basically, a season and a half later, he's already making his way up to Seattle, plays 127 games in his rookie year, 16 home runs, a .264 batting average. Believe it or not, it's so funny, hindsight being 2020 here, believe it or not, finished third in the American League Rookie of the Year running. Now, in case you were wondering, who beat out Griffey for the top two spots in the Rookie of the Year voting? Tom Gordon of the Kansas City Royals, well, he was number two. Number one, you ready for this? Greg Olson, the longtime relief pitcher. He was Rookie of the Year for the Baltimore Orioles, 64 games, a 1.69 earned run average that year. Yay, that's worthy of Rookie of the Year status. But you look at the rest of Greg Olson's career, you know, he bounced around Atlanta, Kansas City, Cleveland, Arizona. I mean, this guy was all over the map before his career wrapped up in 2001. Now, he had a very lengthy, serviceable career, ended up with 217 saves in 622 games. But yeah, when you look at Greg Olson versus Ken Griffey Jr., we know in the long run who won that battle there. So, interesting little side note to Griffey's career. But after that, I mean, it was all Ken Griffey Jr. just dominating. He was the AL MVP in 1997, was constantly in the race. Gold Glove outfielder, Silver Slugger, as I mentioned, 13-time All-Star. He had 11 consecutive All-Star appearances, and he was an absolute fan favorite, not just in Seattle, but all of Major League Baseball. And even here, you know, growing up in Tampa, and of course at the time we didn't have a baseball team, but you would watch Seattle and, you know, watching Ken Griffey Jr. do his thing, you know, hit a home run in 8 consecutive games that tied a Major League record. You know, the incredible athletic ability in the outfield. I mean, he could cover a lot of ground playing center field. This guy was just fun to watch, even from a few thousand miles away. And he carried the kid demeanor. Of course, that was his nickname, you know, wearing the baseball cap backwards, always had a smile on his face, always seemed like he was having fun. Now, that was different from reality in many senses. It is well known now that while he was in the minor leagues in 1988, Griffey actually tried to commit suicide. He ingested a couple hundred aspirin pills trying to kill himself, and it just earned him a trip to the emergency room. But that stemmed from pressures of being the best high school baseball player, being the number one pick in the draft, being the son of a legendary baseball player. And, you know, apparently there was a lot of tension at home throughout his childhood. And, you know, to his credit, Griffey shared that story, but he also mentioned that the suicide attempt actually brought him and his dad closer. So you'd rather not have that type of tension and that near tragedy do that. But in the end, it did become a good thing. And of course, the father-son relationship became well-known. They were teammates in Seattle in 1990, and they hit back-to-back home runs. Of course, that's a legendary highlight against the California Angels in a game in 1990. So the legend started. You know, there were darker clouds in the background for much of his career. A lot of people thought that he was a surly person, could be a little difficult to deal with at times. But really, the public persona of Ken Griffey Jr. Still carries to this day. And the baseball card hobby is one big reason why it's like that, because we all remember card number one of 89 Upper Deck. It was smiling Ken Griffey Jr. Of course, now we know that the Mariners hat was basically photoshopped on, but that image of Ken Griffey Jr. still to this day resonates with baseball fans. And that's why he was much loved in Seattle. It was a bitter breakup with him and the Mariners as he moved on to Cincinnati. Interesting backstory behind that. He lived in Orlando, still has a house in the Orlando area, and he was neighbors with Payne Stewart, the pro golfer. Well, Payne Stewart, of course, dying in a plane crash in 1999. Well, Ken Griffey Jr. is an amateur pilot. So here's an amateur pilot who loses a friend in Payne Stewart and a neighbor. And apparently that is what set off the trade demand. He wanted to be closer to family. And I remember here in Tampa, everyone's like, well, you have a house in Orlando. You should play for the Devil Rays. Sure. Yeah, that was going to happen, especially with Vince Namoli running the Devil Rays back then. Not a chance. Of course, Griffey still had a lot of family in the Cincinnati area, so that is where he ended up. Now, what added a little bit of insult to Griffey's career and this particular trade demand was injury and all the years of just crashing into the wall at the Kingdom and running on that artificial turf. It took its toll, and it took its toll right when he started his career with Cincinnati. And I remember his first year, the 2000 season, he had a pretty good season. But after that, it seemed like it was never shocking news when Griffey was injured with the Reds. And he would deal with a lot of injury-shortened seasons for a good 3 or 4 years while he was with Cincinnati. Got traded to the White Sox in 2008. Was part of the White Sox playoff push. They would get eliminated by the Rays in the first round. And then, of course, came back to Seattle in 2009 and 2010 and abruptly retired right in the middle of the 2010 season, much to the chagrin of Mariners fans and management. But, of course, you know, you look at his stats, you look at how he was playing. He was a shell of his former self here. So it was right to pull the chute, not necessarily right to do it right in the middle of a season. But you could clearly see that Ken Griffey Jr. of 2010 was nowhere near what he was in 1990 and not even 2000, you know, before injuries started robbing him of his productivity. But it's just one of those great what ifs. You know, what if Griffey was able to stay healthy instead of playing, you know, 60 or 70 games a season in Cincinnati? What if he could make it to 110 or 120? You know, he could have naturally passed Aaron in the home run column. This is a guy who, you know, he already had a pretty impressive resume, but he could have passed 3,000 hits. A lot of people don't know that. 22 years of Major League Baseball, Ken Griffey Jr. was just a little over 200 hits shy of 3,000. He finished with 2,781. That's a little mind-blowing when you think of it. So, you know, it's unfortunate that the injuries robbed him of some of his prime years, his early 30s, and what should have been a happy homecoming in Cincinnati. And of course, with him not in the lineup, you know, the Reds struggled for many of those seasons. And some people will say that Jr. got a little lax and lazy then, and the Reds suffered. You know, that's not my opinion. That's just stuff that I've read and have heard over the years. But what should have been a happy homecoming for him wasn't, but it was a pretty warm homecoming for him going back to Seattle. And of course, he's in the Mariners Hall of Fame. He's in the Reds Hall of Fame, too, and of course, the Baseball Hall of Fame. And they've retired his number 24. He was basically the franchise. And the Mariners had some really good players throughout the 90s, which makes his departure after the 99 season even more mystical. What if he stayed there? Can you imagine? I mean, the Mariners, especially that 2001 team, you know, they won all those games. What was it, 120 games, and didn't win a World Series. They lost to the Yankees in the ALCS that year. Can you imagine that team with Griffey, with A-Rod at his peak? It really would have been something if they were able to keep the whole band together, but they couldn't. Of course, they'd moved Randy Johnson before. They'd moved some other players too. But that's another great what if. You know, we talked about some of the what ifs with the Houston Astros. You know, would they have won at least one World Series had they not, you know, traded a few players or you know, left a few players go to free agency? Certainly the Mariners, you can wonder about that, and Ken Griffey Jr. But even though there are, you know, like I said, some dark clouds in his career, you know, he may not have been as jovial as his image was, according to some people, he is still one of the premier players, not only of the 1990s, but really I think of this last era of baseball players. And in the steroid era, with a guy who, again, from all accounts, did it clean, I think especially if you look back at the 1990s, Ken Griffey Jr. was the face of Major League Baseball. And we've talked before about, you know, how Bo Jackson was the star of sports in the late 80s. Deion Sanders took that spotlight a little bit. Michael Jordan definitely took it over in the 90s. Certainly in all sports, you could say he was the number one athlete and definitely led in NBA. But I think without a doubt, when it comes to Major League Baseball, even though you had Canseco, you had McGuire, you had Sosa, you had Bonds, you had a lot of good players, you know, A-Rod, an emerging Derek Jeter. You had a lot of great players in the 1990s, but I think the face of Major League Baseball for that decade, without a doubt, Ken Griffey Jr., and I think he was one of the best players from this last era of baseball players. And of course, you know, the Hall of Fame votes prove it. His stats prove it. So, you know, what more can you say about Ken Griffey Jr. except I was very fortunate to see him, not in person play, but to see him numerous times on television, in a lot of key playoff games, a lot of fun all-star games. He's the only guy to hit a home run that hit the train warehouse at the all-star game in Baltimore. He's the only guy to hit that warehouse, period, in any game. But he did that during, not the all-star game, during the home run derby. So, I mean, this guy was just so incredibly talented, so ridiculously talented. And we're all very fortunate, A, that the suicide attempt didn't work, and B, when he was able to get his mind right and get out there and perform, boy, could he perform. He was an absolute treat to watch, and he can basically run for mayor of Seattle, regardless of whatever his political leanings are, and win it overnight. So there you go, Ken Griffey Jr., card number 77, series 1 of 91 Donruss, a set that I like. But it's something that you probably shouldn't go out of your way to get because there is way too much of it out of there, which is, of course, a very common problem with sets in 1991. Now, we're actually starting to wind down our sets from 1991. We've got two more, and they're two of my favorites. And we're going to start with the new one, Topps Stadium Club, in our next podcast, which will come your way Tuesday via Audioboom and iTunes. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gumstains for the latest news and the conversation. Again, from 1 through 10, the top 10 worst baseball card sets, in your opinion. Go. I want to see what you have to say. And we'll talk about that in our next podcast, which does come after Christmas. Have a fun, have a safe, have an enjoyable Christmas holiday. To all of our friends in Canada listening, enjoy your Boxing Day on the 26th, and we'll meet together again on the 27th for another edition of Wax Ecstatic.